This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Joy Powers. COVID-19 has changed political campaigning. Large rallies meant to drum up support aren't happening in the same way. And the Democratic National Convention was a mostly virtual event. This means the already cavernous echo chamber of social media has the potential to become even more influential. Amber Wachowski is an associate professor of political science at Marquette University and the director of the Marquette Democracy Lab. She's working with Parrish Papadla, professor of marketing at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee and co-director of the Northwestern Data Science Institute. Wachowski and Papadla are coordinating on a project that's tracking the major issues engaging both candidates and voters in the 2020 election. They spoke with Lake Effect's Becca Schimmel about how more screen time and less FaceTime could impact this year's election.
You know, there's a lot of concern about the integrity of these technologies in the sense of kind of who's speaking when we are encountering information on social media. Questions about how misinformation might kind of propagate and spread across the internet. We're now seeing in the headlines here discussions about conspiracy theories. This is certainly not anything that is new to American politics. You know, the sort of discussions of conspiracies, you know, go back to the, you know, to the early 1800s. But the question about how our social media is transforming our electoral environment, I see it in a couple different ways. One is we have definitely seen in the context of social movements the ability for activists to kind of use these technologies to spread their message, to kind of mobilize their supporters. Some have called it this sort of organizing without organization. Whether we're thinking about these hashtag campaigns like Black Lives Matter or Me Too, and the ways in which they've really come up through the grassroots. At the same time, there's concern about the people who use social media, especially those who are tweeting, in this case on Twitter, about politics. They tend to come from the more ideological extreme of the electorate. And there's this concern that folks are not really engaging in any sort of democratic deliberation, but they're just in their echo chambers. And that is hardening their perspectives, their views, in a way making them less tolerant of those, in this case, on the other side of the political aisle. And so in some sense, it might kind of undermine our democracy in some sense if we don't have a shared basis of fact and experience that we're all part of. In 2016, we had a lot of attention to whether it was bots and kind of who's directing these bots and trying to spread information on the internet, the role of Russia, for example, and trying to meddle in our electoral system. And so, you know, following this out, you know, in many ways, it's kind of like campaign advertising where government tries to regulate, right, the spending of money and what you get is almost like a whack-a-mole kind of problem, right, where you have us address one particular issue and then something else emerges. And it kind of feels like we're in this space right now with social media. Questions, you know, going on not just about bots, but now questions about deepfakes and the ability for people to manipulate video, you know, and audio content and not having an ability to really kind of check the truthfulness. Like, what is truth in this environment?
I want to bring in one more point. We were concerned about this issue right from the start of the project. The fact that everything that we are able to monitor and collect on social media may not be genuine. There could be bots talking. There could be misinformation that's being spread. So we had to take a stand on what we would do about that, right? The consensus was that while on the one hand, bots are not genuine, on the other hand, to the extent that the large social media companies are not able to continuously spot them, stop them, and eliminate them from the discussion, bots are definitely influencing people's thinking. So to the extent that they are a part of the process, regardless of whether you like it or not, it's important to collect what they're saying and understand how they're affecting what people think, right? So we took a decision that we're going to collect everything that's coming out on social media and analyze that and track it. On the one hand, I would, based on everything that is happening in terms of the regulatory processes, the hearings in Congress, and just the increased discussion of the issue in the media, that there is more sensitization to the issue of security, which would then mean that there are steps being taken to keep the discussions more genuine. That said, it's a losing battle. The moment that a social media company comes up with an approach to stop a bot, someone else comes out with a new bot, right? And that has to be stopped too. So I think it's a battle that's an ongoing thing. All I think we can say is that the efforts into controlling fakes and things that are not true or genuine have increased, but I don't think we have come to a point where they can be stopped or they are stopped.
Since the normalization of using these tools in politics, what are some key things or changes that have stood out to you in the political sphere?
Right. Well, I mean, clearly it has become a much more of a, what I would call a digital battle for minds than a traditional battle for minds, right? In the traditional process, candidates would go door to door, talk to people, meet people, understand what they're saying, tell them what they think they about the issues and so on. That's the process, right? Now, with the digitization of the discourse and with the echo chamber that Amber was referring to, I think the one side effect has been the hardening of views that would be consistent with what I already believe. If I believe something, social media are feeding me what they think I want to see, that's making me much more hardened in my opinions. And so I think it had the effect of dividing us as a society, right? And politicians obviously are catering to that. So they know that people are going to want to hear what they want to hear, and there are tools to do that. And so politicians are also reaching out to people that they know will support them and telling them what they want to hear. So I don't know what the overall effect of this on our democracy is. And so that's, I think, the effect of the digitization.
Yeah, I really do think it's really a case of contrast and some contradictions as well. You definitely see evidence here of the democratizing force of social media. And I'll just give the example of online discussions about racial justice. So earlier this year, the Electorator Project, we gathered data on how people are talking about racial justice issues on Twitter. We looked at how the candidates are talking about these issues. And then we just looked at what you might think of as like the mainstream news coverage of this issue. So here looking at the big newspaper, national newspapers, as well as cable news. And we're able to kind of track this out over time to see kind of who's leading whom, who's driving the conversations here. And it used to be, you know, the classic studies from the 1970s about agenda setting would say, wow, it's really our political elites. It's the power of the media to kind of shape which issues voters are thinking about, right? They're kind of driving the train here. But in this particular case, what we're observing is that these discussions on social media are not being reactive. They're helping to drive that conversation, right? We saw this kind of playing out throughout the summer, just even thinking about the ways in which these mass protests took place across the country. On the flip side, you know, we also see evidence to speak to the point about people are in their echo chambers and the ways in which confirmation bias works to kind of keep us deeply polarized. There's also evidence that it's helping to feed what we call affective polarization, the idea that I'm attracted to a party, a political party, less because of the things that that party stands for, but more because I can't stand the other party. If you're not having a campaign environment that it's really kind of the broad discussion and vetting of these issues, you know, what does that say about the quality of our democracy? And so, you know, I guess I'm somewhat inspired by efforts of people to always wanting to do better, finding ways to kind of take the best of social media. But can we find ways to actually facilitate our, you know, kind of the flourishing of democracy? Are there ways that we should be designing our algorithms, right, so that I'm not just getting fed a steady diet of things that already sit with my predispositions, but might actually increase my exposure to different points of view? I mean, for me, as a political scientist who's interested in that sort of deliberative democracy, for me, that's where I would love to see social media go. But I don't think we're there yet.
Now that many people are working in their homes and large gatherings have moved to digital spaces, we're relying on the internet more than ever. How has that impacted our ability to truly understand the current political climate?
Change in how we work, I think, has had and will continue to have major significance for our culture and society in the following sense, right? I'm working at my computer day in and day out. And who am I interacting with? I'm interacting with the media. I'm interacting with my friends through social media. What that then means is that I'm only interacting with things and those that I'm comfortable with and that I identify with. I'm no longer exposed to a diversity of views, which would happen when I went to work. Regardless of whether I like it or not, I would meet Joe Smith at the water cooler, and if Joe has a different point of view and starts talking to me, I'm not going to ask him to shut up and walk off, right? I'm going to listen to that. So I'm picking up that a different point of view as I go into the world. Here, I'm forced to avoid that, or rather, maybe I prefer to avoid that, and I'm listening to essentially what I want to listen to. So I think it's going to have an enormous impact on the rifts in our society. And it's going to ripple through politics and culture and a lot of other things. So I think it's not something that is a one-time thing that's happening to us. I think it's going to have very long-term consequences.
You know, Purush, your point there about our conversations at the water cooler being kind of some of the few opportunities we have to engage political differences. You know, there's some work that's now almost 20 years old that really finds that, yeah, our shared work environments, our jobs are kind of where we're most likely to encounter people who hold differences in political views. I mean, that was changing a bit with just how polarized our country has become. Many Americans have just stopped talking about politics in general, right? They just know it's uncomfortable and they're just going to avoid it. But the point about how with all of us working and not having those sort of serendipitous, you know, the random conversations about issues and what that might mean to our polity, you know, I hadn't really, I guess I'm still in it and thinking that maybe we're going to get on the other side and that like life somehow returns to normal. But I think as this continues on, we are going to see more and more employers seeing that it actually makes business sense for them to actually have their workers working remotely.
How effective do you think activism is in the digital space, such as online petitions and calls for change on social media?
I think it's enormously effective because going back to the whole idea of democratization, I think that's one area where the democratization of individual voices is obvious, right? Whereas earlier, even if I believed in something or even if I wanted to be active about something, it would have been an extremely heavy lift for me to go out and build a movement around that idea. Now, I can jump online, and if I have enough friends online that believe in what I'm saying, and they have friends, the message is going to just ripple through, right? Clearly, the message has to be something that people would identify with. But if it is, building that broad base for the message is much, much faster and less in effort compared to the days of pre-social media. And of course, that brings with it its own dangers, right? I mean, regardless of whether the idea has merit or not, what its implications for society are, good and bad ideas both can build up momentum. I think it's a double-edged sword, but the sword is here.
Yeah, on this question about online activism, you know, I think we have some cases that kind of at least give should give us a little pause about how effective relying on online activism alone will be. And I'll just bring up Occupy Wall Street, I think, as an example here, right, where we saw it was, you know, Adbusters kind of putting it out on Twitter, you know, Occupy Wall Street, and it spread, right, like wildfire. And you had all of those people, protesting and occupying space, not just in New York, but in many other cities, in Oakland, in Madison, Wisconsin, and, you know, all across the country. And it seemed like, oh, maybe we're at a tipping point. But I think it also gives us pause in the sense that while campaigns can really get going off the ground and can really go viral, kind of sustaining them in a way that these movements can actually influence politics, right, and kind of work through and kind of continue and have a more long-lasting change, you still need the organizational infrastructure. It can't just be organizing without organization. And so I'll give, like, Black Lives Matter, I think, is a good example of where you've got this kind of hybrid setup, right? Where you've got these hashtags, that really are able to leverage social media and to spread the message and to kind of get it in the public consciousness. But you also have chapters and groups kind of sprouting up in all sorts of cities and kind of taking on, like, the hard politics, whether it's like increasing participation in local elections or trying to get new DAs elected, you know, across the country. You're seeing that they're not abandoning the sort of old style of politics or old style of organizing. It's just one more tool in the toolkit. And that's the way I think that we should think about online activism. It's one more tool in the toolkit. But if that's all you're relying on, I just don't think that's going to be quite effective.
Moving forward, what are your concerns about the reliance on the internet and social media tools during this election year?
I have one. I've been telling my students, I'm teaching a class on campaigns and elections, that given the new reality in which many Americans will be casting their ballots by mail, right, voting absentee, it's likely, if this is a really close race, that we won't know who the winner is on election night. But we have the internet and the ability where people are reporting out the election returns and trying to make sense of them. I'm really curious about how the major news outlets are going to be covering this election as the returns come in. But I guess I am, you know, concerned about efforts to sort of undermine the integrity of the elections, or to kind of cast doubt, I should say, on the integrity of the elections, to kind of say, well, you know, it looked like so-and-so was up, you know, at 10 o'clock or at 11 o'clock at night, but now 2 days later, we found more, you know, we've tabulated those absentee ballots, and now the other candidate's up. And so my fear is that while that is a perfectly legitimate, right, playing out of this election in these times, that on election night, there could be, right, the sort of confusion, chaos, the sowing of discord, and this sort of undermining the integrity, you know, or the perceived integrity of the elections. So it's something that I think, I'm only one, you know, teacher here telling my students, you know, counseling patience. But I do think that this is going to be really important this election year, because these are really trying times. It's uncertain, the great kind of uncertainty in which the election will play out, and the fact that millions of Americans will be voting by mail for the very first time likely means that it's not going to feel like a normal election night, and that should be okay. We should have some patience and let those votes come in and be counted.
Once again, I want to go back to this, although I don't want to sound like a broken record. I think it's a double-edged sword, the internet, right? And the good edge of that sword is that I think it's one way for more and more members of the society to get engaged in the process, right? You're able to actually get more insight, more information on what's going on and the issues are. Clearly, there are questions about whether all that information is valid, but more people are engaged. And it could also become a tool to mobilize more interest in going out and voting, right? Because you can exhort people that it's important to go out and vote. So that's the positive side of the sword. The negative side of the sword that I really worry about is in addition to all the issues that we talked about the echo chamber idea, about, you know, interacting with only people and opinions that you already have, I'm really concerned about interference and information coming from outside the country, right? I'm worried about, given how global the reach of the internet and social media is, right? There's no way that we can fully stop or even control the flow of information from beyond our borders, be it for good or for bad. So my concern is, what does that do to our democracy? It's we, the people here, who should be judging the issues here, who should be deciding on what is important to us. But now there's a massive unknown and unseen set of voices coming from outside our borders. How do we deal with that? That's my concern.
Amber Wachowski is an associate professor of political science at Marquette University, and Parrish Papadla is a professor of marketing at UW-Milwaukee. They spoke with Lake Effect's Becca Schimmel.